So in the middle of verse 18, Jesus says, the Son of Man will. The Son of Man will. The last time he has spoken those five words was in chapter 19, verse 28. The Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne. And as he speaks them again here, the disciples are doubtless expecting something similar to that previous announcement. Another exciting description of Jesus' future exaltation. It does seem to have caught their imagination, doesn't it? This idea of Jesus regally enthroned. In next week's passage, James and John, with a bit of help from their mum, will bring it back into the conversation. And so, as I say, when Jesus uses here the same introduction as before, the Son of Man will, their ears doubtless prick up, their pulses quicken. Jesus' messianic career at this point seems to them probably a bit dull. All he's doing is travelling mile after mile of dry, dusty Judean countryside, his progress constantly interrupted, aggressive Pharisees, enthusiastic parents with their kids, a young man asking about eternal life. It all just lacks a certain glamour and verve. But now, Jesus is going to give them a prospect to salivate over. Now he's going to lift their eyes to his coming exaltation and enthronement, to that day when he will be raised from all this present banality. That's what they're eagerly expecting as they huddle around him here. And sure enough, Jesus does speak of being raised. He uses that verb here. The Son of Man will be raised in order to indeed sit on that glorious throne. Jesus does say that. But everything else about his utterance here in verses 18 and 19 is a million miles away from what the disciples had in mind. You see, when Jesus is eventually raised, it won't be merely from a situation of banality. It will be from a situation vastly, vastly worse. The disciples expect the verb be raised to come straight after the Son of Man will. But it doesn't come straight after. A whole load of other verbs come first. Ugly, nasty, terrible verbs, horrendous experiences the Son of Man will undergo before ever he's raised. I'm saying our text this morning doesn't describe the details of Jesus' enthronement as the disciples probably hoped. It describes the route to Jesus' enthronement. And that route could not be more different from the thing that it's the route to, from the enthronement itself. Jesus' journey to those soaring heights will be via the most plunging depths. And so as we get into these verses then, there are two things in particular that I want us to consider. And first of all, the staggering horrors expressed by Jesus' words. The staggering horrors expressed by Jesus' words. And we'll spend longer on this morning. So the route to his enthronement then, as it's set out here, it involves for Jesus at least five staggering horrors. Let's look at them in turn. First of all, his trust abused. His trust abused. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes. That's how the ESV puts it in verse 18. But most of the other versions say the Son of Man will be betrayed into the hands of the chief priests and scribes. Certainly the Greek word can have that specific meaning, and Matthew has already used the word to unambiguously foretell Jesus' betrayal back in chapter 10, verse 4. You know, I think when considering Jesus' sufferings, we tend to underplay this aspect of it, Jesus' betrayal. I've had conversations with one or two of you about that striking statement that we have in John chapter 13, where John announces that Satan entered into Judas Iscariot. There seems to be this tension in the Gospels. We wonder at times what's happening. Is Satan trying to pull Jesus away from the cross? That's how it appears in the desert temptations, for instance, and at one or two other points. Or is Satan trying to push Jesus onto the cross? That's how it appears when he enters into Judas Iscariot. I mean, if he is instigating the betrayal that will trigger the arrest and the trial and so on, then presumably Satan must want Jesus on that cross. Well, Sinclair Ferguson makes this very suggestive comment. He says, since Satan could not destroy Jesus by the temptation to go another way than to the cross, now he would seek to dominate the event itself. Now he would seek to dominate the event itself. I think he means that rather than seek to avert Passion Weekend, which was a lost cause for Satan, he would seek to throw into Passion Weekend details that were so dark and so twisted and so sordid that even Jesus, for all his resolve and determination, would hopefully flip. And the point then in John 13 is that betrayal into the hands of Judas Iscariot is one of those details. It's one thing for Jesus to simply be found in that olive grove on that Thursday night by a bunch of the chief priests' henchmen. It's another thing altogether for those henchmen to be aided and abetted by one of Jesus' closest companions. Satan hopes that the perversity of that treachery will undo Jesus, that it will tip him over the edge, that it will produce some kind of reaction in him that will jeopardize his mission. And my point then is that if Satan saw such potential in Jesus' betrayal, then you and I shouldn't underplay this as some unremarkable component of the story. Perhaps we do so because we've never fully appreciated what a socially dependent person Jesus was. Jesus needed companionship. He was no self-sufficient loner. He needed people close to him. You sense that here in our text, actually, verse 17. As Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, dot, dot, dot. By the way, why does Jesus foretell his sufferings at this particular point? We might picture him having a kind of discipleship curriculum somewhere to hand. And he's frequently consulting that curriculum. Okay, what do I need to teach them today then? Ah, yes, it's time for another lesson on the cross. I'll do that. I'm not sure it was like that. I wonder rather whether there's a kind of domino thing going on here. In chapter 19, verse 21, Jesus says to that rich guy that he's talking to, sell what you possess. I said last week, it may be those words that get Peter thinking about what he has had to relinquish for Jesus' sake. We have left everything and followed you, he remarks in chapter 19, verse 27. And perhaps it's those words of Peter that get Jesus thinking about what he is going to have to relinquish at the end of this journey to Jerusalem. And he really is going to leave everything. Peter was exaggerating. He had become a dependent with less security than he'd had before. Jesus is going to become destitute. Everything he has completely stripped from him. And I would put it to you then that it's as he thinks of that he feels terribly burdened at the prospect, and it's because of that he takes the 12 aside here. Not in the first instance because they need to be taught, but because he needs to be comforted. He needs to offload these thoughts that are troubling him and burdening him so much. He needs to share it with his friends. I'm saying Jesus needed his friends. They weren't a peripheral thing in his life that he could take or leave. He needed his friends. And that's why, as Satan understood, betrayal by one of those friends was a truly crushing experience for Jesus. A little while ago, my sister-in-law and her husband were phoned by their bank. The bank was concerned about withdrawals that had been made from their accounts. They were concerned that someone might be stealing money from them. And so they asked them to log into their online account there and then. So they did that, and sure enough, significant amounts of money had been taken. And James and Esther, as you can imagine, were thrown into something of a panic by this. But the caller from the bank was helpfully sympathetic and calm, and gave various instructions for them to follow. In their confusion, they didn't suspect for one moment that the person on the other end of the phone was not from the bank at all, but was in fact the very one who had been stealing the money, and this was him getting more deeds that they possessed. And what a painful thing then, when someone purporting to be your bank steals your money. How much more painful when someone purporting to be your intimate companion helps your enemies catch you. That's a horror for Jesus, all right. It's a bitter, bitter pill for him to have to swallow. And so I'm saying that's the first staggering horror here, his trust abused. But then a second horror, his reputation ruined. His reputation ruined. So the betrayal will put Jesus into the hands of the chief priests and scribes. And they, verse 18 says, will condemn him to death. It's legal language. They will formally, officially declare him guilty. That's what it means. And that's a weighty thing to happen to someone, isn't it? To be declared guilty by some ruling body with recognized authority, that is a weighty thing. It's a different kettle of fish altogether from merely being disliked and criticized. There's been a lot of disgruntlement this past week surrounding Israel Folau, the Australian rugby player, being signed by a club. He's homophobic and shouldn't be given a contract, people are saying. But the fuss is relatively inconsequential because it's just opinion. It's a bandwagon. It's not the ruling authorities of World Rugby gravely announcing this man is guilty and must not be offered a contract. But when that happens, whether it's the ruling authorities of World Rugby or the official inquiry into the Grenfell Tower disaster or a judge at the Old Bailey, when a very august body declares a guilty verdict, then the person in question is finished. His or her reputation is ruined. And in first century Israel, then, you couldn't get a more august council than the one being referred to here, these chief priests and scribes, the Sanhedrin, as it was known. When there's a terrorist attack or a national disaster in our country, we hear the newsreader utter those words. The Prime Minister is chairing a meeting of COBRA. Now, none of us really knows what a meeting of COBRA is, but I'm sure in all of our minds it just has this association of gravitas. And those are the associations then that the Sanhedrin had for a first century Jew. Its members wore long grey beards and long dark robes. This council just exuded gravitas. The last thing, the very last thing any Jewish mother wanted for her child was that he or she should one day appear before this council and walk out of there having been condemned as guilty. The shame of that was incalculable and irremediable. And that's going to be Jesus' fate. When we think of Passion Weekend, we think of the shame kicking in once Jesus is at Golgotha and is being nailed naked to that cross. And in Roman eyes, that may be so. The execution itself is what it's all about for them. But in Jewish eyes, he's shrouded in shame the moment he receives his verdict in the Sanhedrin. I mean, even for us, that adjective convicted is a toxic one, isn't it? You hear someone say about someone else, he's a convicted, And you haven't even heard the end of the sentence yet. It might be that he's a convicted paedophile. It might be he's a convicted fly tipper. But already you're looking down on him as something of a disgrace because he's been formally convicted. And Jesus is going to be formally convicted. One of the horrors, I'm saying, of Passion Weekend will be the ignominy of legal condemnation. Legal condemnation in the loftiest context that Israelite society knew. So his trust abused, his reputation ruined, and then a third horror, his dignity trampled. His dignity trampled. Because having been condemned, he's then going to be mocked, verse 19. Now we all know that there's mockery and there's mockery. I might come home from a minister's conference and say, at one of the conference mealtimes, I was mocked for my very Yorkshire pronunciation of a particular word. Now, that's not the same, is it, as one of the children coming home and saying, I was mocked today in the school playground. For one thing, I'm a grown man and ought to be able to stand up for myself, but also, when it's a table of Christian ministers, there ought to be certain limits built into the mockery, certain lines that it will not cross. When it's children in the playground, on the other hand, those limits and those lines can't be assumed. The mockery could be genuinely hateful, genuinely intimidating, genuinely crude. And notice then with this mockery that Jesus is going to experience, we're given a crucial detail. It's Gentile mockery. He's going to be delivered over to the Gentiles to be mocked. Now, Jews could mock, and at the cross, Jews would mock. But you would hope with Jewish mockery that there would at least be some limits. The Jews knew the Old Testament, texts like 2 Kings 2, where a bunch of mocking boys are mauled by bears, and Proverbs 20, verse 1, where it's drinking too much wine that turns people into mockers. They had some awareness in the back of their minds, at least, that mockery must be regulated, and it must be controlled, and it must be reined in. Gentiles, on the other hand, were bound by no such restraints. Like in the school playground, there was unlimited potential for mockery of the most hateful, intimidating, and crude kind. In fact, we may go a step further. The mockery of which Jesus speaks here doesn't simply proceed from Gentiles. According to verse 19, it proceeds from the same Gentiles who will also flog and crucify Jesus. What Gentiles are those? Well, Gentile soldiers, of course. And so that's who the mockers are in our text. And sure enough, when we come to Matthew's passion narrative, the only Gentiles we are explicitly told mock Jesus are the Roman soldiers. And they are hard men. If as mere Gentiles, they might perhaps have had some common grace sensibilities at least. Some sense of decency and propriety. As Gentile soldiers, all of that has been driven from them by the regular task of butchering people at Jerusalem's execution sites. That was not a job calculated to make you well-mannered and gentlemanly. In connection with these men, Don Carson refers to barracks vulgarity. That's probably understating it. In their mockery, we may assume that anything goes. There's nothing to which they will not stoop in mocking Jesus. No word is too coarse. No name is too offensive. No simile is too humiliating. No comment is too rude. They will throw at Jesus the maximum scorn which their depraved minds can think up. And remember, Jesus is wired exactly the same way that you and I are. Think for a moment about our eyes. And we're very sensitive about our eyes, aren't we? We can contemplate the thought of taking a bash to the legs or to the arms. But our eyes being messed around with, that's unbearable. And there's another part of us that's similarly sensitive. Only this time, not a bodily organ. I'm talking about our dignity. The thought of a situation at work or amongst your friends where your dignity is seriously undermined, that's unbearable, isn't it? It's just a human thing. Animals aren't like that. Your pet dog goes to the toilet in full view of passers-by and has slobber dripping from its mouth all the time. Dignity isn't on its radar. This is a human thing. And Jesus, then, is a human. He's as instinctively sensitive as anyone else is about his dignity. And his dignity isn't merely going to be undermined. It's going to be trampled. A torrent of uncensored Gentile mockery is going to break his heart. Again, horror is the right word. His dignity trampled. So his trust abused, his reputation ruined, his dignity trampled. And then a fourth thing. His body battered. His body battered. Not only will he be mocked, he will also be flogged. There are a couple of well-known Bible texts relating to Jesus' sufferings, which at first sight seem strange. You think of Luke's reference in Luke 23:26 to a random stranger being drafted in to carry Jesus' cross. According to John 19:17, Jesus was initially carrying his cross himself. Well, what's the matter with him then? Why can't he carry it all the way? He's a young man. He's been accustomed in Nazareth to heaving great pieces of wood around the place. And Golgotha isn't miles away. This isn't like Samson carrying Gaza's gates all the way to Hebron or something. Why can't he do this? It seems strange. Or you think of Isaiah's reference in Isaiah 52:14 to Messiah's appearance being marred beyond human semblance. Alec Mattia captures the meaning well when he says, those who saw him stepped back in horror, not only saying, is this the servant, but is this human? But why should it be? Why should his whole appearance be so altered? Again, it seems strange. But I think the explanation for both those texts lies in this detail. Jesus being flogged. You see, just as there's mockery and there's mockery, there's flogging and there's flogging. And the flogging which the Romans inflicted on men they were about to crucify was off the scale in its savagery. It involved the victim being stripped and tied to a post so that he couldn't evade the blows. It involved a whip made of strips of leather with pieces of metal inserted into the strips of leather. It involved the victim being lashed and lashed to the point where internal organs might well be exposed, to the point where the victim might well die without even the need for subsequent crucifixion. And Jesus is going to experience that. That's why he has no strength left to carry the cross. It's an heroic achievement that he managed to get on his feet again at all. Let alone walk to Golgotha, let alone walk some of the way carrying the cross on his shoulders. And it's also why his appearance is marred beyond human semblance. He has been treated as a piece of meat. His flesh reduced to a heap of formless pulp. His body turned into one giant open wound. Truly, this too is a horror for Jesus. His body battered. His trust abused. His reputation ruined. His dignity trampled. His body battered. And then one last horror. His life extinguished. His life extinguished. He's going to be crucified. Crucifixion was the Romans' favorite method of execution. For them, it perfectly combined effectiveness and horror. Effectiveness because it had a 100% success rate. You never encountered a crucifixion survivor. The Apostle Paul was once stoned, you remember, and lived to tell the tale. You didn't get crucified and live to tell the tale. It was a ruthlessly effective killing method. And then horror, because you died slowly and agonizingly. Decapitation, like John the Baptist experienced, may sound barbaric to us, but at least it was mercifully quick. With crucifixion, the whole thing dragged on hour after hour after hour. I mean, it's a big deal for humans, isn't it? For us humans, how we die. We know we're going to die, but it's a big deal how we die. You remember how King Saul was so anxious not to die being tortured by the Philistines that he threw himself onto his sword. You think of how we all want to know, did the basketball player and his fellow passengers know that they were going to crash last Sunday? Did they experience that terror, or did it just happen in an instant? It's a big deal to us how we die, and this is how Jesus is going to die, in the worst possible way. And so I'm saying then, this is Jesus' route to the enthronement, a route of staggering horrors. His trust abused, his reputation ruined, his dignity trampled, his body battered, his life extinguished. And so we must ask the question, why? Why does the raising that he comes to right at the end, why does the raising to that glorious throne have to be from a situation of such direness? Why does he have to plunge so low before he soars so high? Well, on the face of things, our text doesn't seem to answer the question. But briefly, we must move on to our second main heading. We've considered the staggering horrors expressed by Jesus' words. Let's notice, secondly, the subtle hints embedded in Jesus' words. The subtle hints embedded in Jesus' words. The answer to the why question is there. It's there in the form of subtle hints. Let me just flag up three as we close. First of all, an intriguing ambiguity. An intriguing ambiguity. Now, I said that it's with good reason that the other versions opt for the word betrayed rather than delivered there in the middle of verse 18. But I now want to say that it's also with good reason that the ESV opts for the word delivered there in verse 18. The word can have that less specific, that more general meaning. Now you might be thinking, well, Dan, that's a bit wishy-washy. It's your job to tell us which is right. Well, I think this is a deliberate ambiguity. Betrayal by Judas Iscariot is in view here, certainly. And so we were right to talk about staggering horror number one, his trust abused. But something else is also in view here. There are only two verbs in this list of experiences that Jesus foretells. There are only two verbs where we're not given the subject, we're not given the person doing the thing. We're told who does the condemning, we're told who does the mocking and the flogging and the crucifying, but it's the first and the last verbs where we're not told who's doing it. Now, with the last, there's no doubt whatsoever, is there? Who does the raising? Clearly God does the raising. We can all agree on that. And it would give the text a certain symmetry, therefore, if it's also God who ultimately is the subject of the first verb. He does the delivering over there in verse 18. I don't think that's reading too much into the text. I think we're meant to detect here an agent behind the human agents mentioned, a divine agent, that the same God who at the end of our text raises Jesus, at the beginning of our text, hands Jesus over to the suffering in the first place. You hear that question asked so often, don't you? Where was God when? Where was God when the towers came down in New York City? Where was God when 6 million Jews were killed in the gas chambers? Where is God here? Where is God as the Son of Man has all of this done to him? Well, the answer is God is in the driving seat. God is in the director's chair. God is the one initiating the whole thing. That's why Jesus can say that all of this stuff is going to happen in Jerusalem while still continuing on his way to Jerusalem. I mean, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that if Jesus knows all this stuff is going to happen there, he'd be running in the opposite direction. And certainly if the whole thing in Jerusalem was only going to be man's doing, then Jesus might well run in the opposite direction. But it's going to be God's doing. It's a divine appointment he has in that city. And so tremblingly, he moves toward it, not away from it. An intriguing ambiguity. But then a second hint, a definite echo. A definite echo. Notice there at the beginning of verse 19, those words, deliver him over to the Gentiles. Now, several times in the Old Testament, that phrase is used in connection with God inflicting punishment. A punishment that God inflicts is handing people over to the nations, the Gentiles. So you have it in Ezra chapter 9 and verse 7. There Ezra is praying a great prayer of kind of corporate repentance. And this is what he says, Ezra 9 verse 7. From the days of our fathers to this day we have been in great guilt. And for our iniquities we, our kings and our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands. It says, but in the Greek version of Ezra, it's nations, being given into the hand of the kings of the nations. So Ezra is saying there, because of our sin, we have been handed by you, O God, given over to the nations. You have it in Psalm 106, verse 41, a psalm which recalls many of the dark episodes of Israel's history. And it seems like at this point in verses 40 and 41, the psalmist is recalling the judges period and the way in which there, you remember, because of sin, the nations were allowed to oppress God's people again and again. And this is how he puts it. Verse 40, then the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people and he abhorred his heritage. He gave them into the hand of the nations, the same phrase. And then you have it also in Ezekiel 31, verse 11. There it's not God's own people. There it's Pharaoh whose judgment is being foretold. And it's said of him that he's going to be handed over to the nations, probably a reference to Nebuchadnezzar, who is going to bring him down. And in the light then of that echo, one writer puts it in this way, for Jesus to be handed over to the nations is tantamount to being delivered over to the wrath of God. In other words, God is more than just initiating. That's what we saw a moment ago. God is the one who is driving all this suffering. But now we're saying it's more than that. He's not just initiating. He's specifically putting Jesus through all this in a spirit of wrath and as a means of punishment. And that's extraordinary, isn't it? Only three chapters ago, Jesus is on top of a mountain and God is saying, I am well pleased with him. And yet now, in chapter 20, Jesus is foretelling an experience of divine punishment. What's going on here? Well, that leads us to our third subtle hint. We've had an intriguing ambiguity, a definite echo, but thirdly, a repeated detail. A repeated detail. And the repeated detail to which I'm referring seems at first sight very inconsequential indeed. It's that reference to going up to Jerusalem. verse 17, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. And then it's repeated, verse 18, in Jesus' own words, we are going up to Jerusalem. Two things about that. Physically, they are not yet going up to Jerusalem. I mean, post Jericho, the journey will take them up and they will climb the height of a Scottish Munro in getting from Jericho to Jerusalem. But they haven't reached Jericho yet. That comes later in this chapter. At the moment, they're not particularly climbing. And yet Jesus says, we are going up to Jerusalem. But you see, the second thing is that this too is an Old Testament echo. In the Old Testament, you get this language of going up to Jerusalem, most famously in the psalm I read to you earlier on this morning, Psalm 122, verse 4. There the tribes go up to Jerusalem. Doesn't matter where they're coming from, they go up to Jerusalem. And it's almost a technical phrase then for what is being described in Psalm 122. What is being described in Psalm 122? Well, it's clearly pilgrimage of the Israelites from all their different places for one of the great festivals. They might live in, dotted around in all sorts of places, but they go up to Jerusalem for these great festivals. And the psalm so beautifully expresses the joy of the Israelites arriving there. And this language then fits the context here in Matthew 20, because they are going up to Jerusalem in the Psalm 122 sense. They're heading there for Passover. That's why you have these references to large crowds back in chapter 19, verse 2. Large crowds are with him. We'll see later on in this chapter, chapter 20, verse 29, there's a great crowd with him. These are fellow pilgrims going from Galilee for the Passover feast in Jerusalem. And so it fits then for this language to be used here of them going up to Jerusalem. And you would expect them then, wouldn't you, on this journey to be talking about an act of butchery that's going to take place once they get there. Because that's what happens on Passover weekend. An act of butchery as the lamb is killed and its blood is used. You would expect that. There's nothing out of the ordinary about that. But what, of course, is so extraordinary here? What is so odd? What is so surprising? Is that they're not talking, Jesus is not talking about an act of butchery done to a lamb, but an act of butchery done to himself. But of course, that's the point, isn't it? Why is all this butchery going to be done to him? Because he is the lamb, the ultimate lamb. What was Passover all about? It was about an animal as a substitute for God's people bearing God's wrath in their place. But of course, no animal could ever do that. And so the thing was always pointing forward to something beyond itself. And now it's arrived at the thing it was pointing towards. Jesus is what it was pointing towards. And all of this is going to happen to him. Not because God's announcement on the Mount of Transfiguration was wrong and God isn't well pleased with him. And there's actually some sin in Jesus' life that needs to be driven out of him by flogging and nails at Calvary. No, Jesus is the well-pleasing Son of God. But all this will happen to him because he's going to bear God's wrath in the place of those who deserve it, in the place of people like us, in the place of all who will trust in him and say, Jesus, be my substitutionary lamb. Have you said that? Can you read these verses this morning and be moved by them, not simply because they're inherently moving in the way that you might watch a film where someone is suffering badly and be moved, but be moved in this vastly deeper way, because you can see this is happening for you. This is what you deserve. This is him taking your place. And if you can't yet see that, please see it this morning, and please come to Jesus. You deserve God's wrath, and you will face God's wrath. You've done and thought and said enough today during this service, while I've been uttering this sentence, to deserve God's wrath. You will face it unless you are trusting on the Passover Lamb, Jesus Christ, who faced it in the place of others. Come to Jesus Christ. And as those of us who are his now eat bread and drink wine, may we be glad with all our hearts for the one who so bravely carried on going up to Jerusalem, not to celebrate the Passover like all the other Jews were, but to be the Passover, to be the butchered lamb. Let's reflect with gratitude on him. Amen.